Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ozachowski and I will be your host for today. Today we have a great show coming up and I'm really excited to have this guest on the program today. Her name is Mary Martin. She is a blogger who hails from Florida in the United States of America, and she runs a fantastic blog that is updated all the time called Animal Person. You can find it at www.animalperson.net. We'll be talking today about language, ethics, economics, and her work as an activist through Project Treadstone and her work with Greyhounds as well. She's an extremely passionate writer and does an amazing job of taking apart some of the language that's used in the AR movement and outside the AR movement to talk about animal issues. So we'll be doing that at about the 20 after point. But first, before we do that, we're going to get to some news. As always, if you want to get in touch with us, you can contact us via email, animalvoices@gmail.com, or you can check out our website and download this show and our nearly 300 archived programs that are up as of today. www.animalvoices.ca. And now for some news. The first piece of news is coming to us today from the Texas Chronicle, which is located at chron.com, chron.com. The headline is "Turkey Plant Worker Sentenced for Animal Cruelty." Lewisburg, West Virginia. A worker at a West Virginia turkey plant was sentenced Monday to a year of home confinement for stomping on a bird's head and slamming another to the ground, abuse that was caught on videotape by animal rights activists. Edward Eric Gwynn of Crawley will be jailed if he violates the terms set by Greenbrier County Circuit Judge James Rowe, who also fined Gwynn $1,000 and ordered him to have no contact with domestic animals. Gwynn and Scott Alvin White of Second Creek were indicted on felony charges in February, but each pleaded guilty to two animal cruelty misdemeanors in April. White was sentenced June 8th to a year in jail but can petition for home confinement, a court clerk said. The men were videotaped last fall by an operative of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals who went undercover to the Aviagen Turkeys Incorporated plant in Lewisburg. Quote, Greenbrier County prosecutors have set an important precedent for cases involving cruelty to animals on factory farms whose abuse has often gone unnoticed, said PETA President Ingrid E. Newkirk in a prepared statement. To all those good people who are appalled at the violence uncovered in this case, we suggest exploring a vegetarian diet. Aviagen, a subsidiary of Alabama-based Aviagen Incorporated, fired both men in November along with co-worker Walter Lee Hambrick of Fairley. Hambrick's case is still pending. In 2004, Norfolk, Virginia-based PETA carried out a similar undercover video sting in West Virginia against Texas-based Pilgrim's Pride at the company's Moorfield plant. The company fired 11 employees in that case, but none were criminally charged. And the second story today coming to us from theglobeandmail.com. The headline is, Vancouver Humane Society sets sights on stampede for calf roping protest. After wrestling British Columbia's biggest rodeo into submission over roping events, the Vancouver Humane Society is taking its campaign against calf roping to the biggest rodeo in the country. But they shouldn't expect a warm welcome, as everyone from Alberta animal rights groups to city newspapers are turning their backs on the initiative aimed at the Calgary Stampede. Advertisements planned for Calgary's daily newspapers were rejected. All stampede rodeo events, including calf or tie-down roping, in which riders rope a calf that's been given a head start, take place according to strict rules concerning animal welfare and are monitored by the Calgary Humane Society and the Alberta Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Stampede spokesman Doug Fraser said Sunday, quote, we are very, very confident in the procedures we take and the work that we do with the Calgary Humane Society and the Alberta SPCA, Mr. Fraser said. The two agencies monitor conditions for rodeo animals as well as animals involved in the stampede's extensive lineup of agricultural events, he added. Where rodeos are concerned, the Alberta animal welfare groups are at odds with the Vancouver Humane Society, which, along with the British Columbia SPCA, was instrumental in getting the Cloverdale Rodeo to eliminate roping events for good in 2007. That ban came after a calf was injured and had to be put down at the rodeo, which is held in May of each year. The Vancouver Humane Society maintains calf roping results in pain and fear for the calves and can kill or maim the animals involved. This week, the Vancouver Humane Society plans to run advertisements in Calgary papers that show a cowboy in the process of roping and wrestling a calf, and they label the cowboy a bully and the calf a baby. After being turned down by the Calgary Herald and the Calgary Sun, the group has agreed to run the advertisement in Fast Forward, a city weekly, Humane Society spokesman Peter Fricker said Sunday. The group has agreed to change the advertisement for the daily papers by removing direct references to the Calgary Stampede, but was still turned down, he said. Quote, "This is not a particularly controversial advertisement," Mr. Fricker said. "This is not a shocking PETA-style ad." Since eliminating roping events, the Cloverdale Rodeo has focused on crowd-friendly contests such as barrel racing and boosted prize money to compensate for the fact that contestants could no longer win points toward national championships by competing in the roping event, spokesman Laura Balance said Sunday. Cloverdale is not a sanctioned rodeo since cutting four traditional roping events. Quote, "The first year was nerve-wracking to see who would show up," Ms. Balance said, adding that attendance was higher this year. Roping events remain crowd-pleasers and help draw the biggest rodeo stars in the world to Calgary, Stampede spokesman Mr. Fraser said. Quote, "This is a tournament of champions, and the fact of the matter is, if we in any way mistreated our animals, they would not perform." According to its website, the Canadian Professional Rodeo Association sanctioned 58 rodeos in Western Canada last year. The Calgary Stampede runs July 3rd to July 12th. It's happening right now. And the next story coming to us from the Agence France-Presse, the headline is, an important one, Namibian animal rights activists bid to stop seal slaughter. In a bid to save tens of thousands of baby seals being killed for their fur, Namibia animal rights activists are rushing to raise millions of dollars to buy out a fur company that buys the pelts. The annual commercial seal harvesting season officially opened on Wednesday with a quota of 85,000 pups due to be clubbed to death on the Namibian coast. Quote, "I got the offer from the Australian-based owner Hatem Yavuz to buy out his company for $14.2 million by mid-July, and I have started an international online appeal to raise the funds," said François Hugo of Seal Alert South Africa, a seal rehabilitation center. Quote, "I have placed the plea on YouTube and Facebook over the weekend, requesting individuals worldwide to pledge $15 each until the target is reached, and many offers have already reached us," Hugo added. Hatem Yavuz even offered to delay for 2 weeks the culling of the Cape Fur seal pups and the shooting of 6,000 bulls by his Namibian partner companies, which were allocated the quotas, Hugo added. The original deadline set by Yavuz last Friday to raise the money by July 1st was too short, he said. However, an official in the Namibian Fisheries Ministry said the cull would kick off Wednesday, as agreed. The ministry set a 3-year rolling quota back in 2007 of 85,000 seal pups annually, plus 6,000 bulls each year to contain Namibia's total seal population of some 850,000 animals. The bulls' dried genitals are popular in China, where they are used for traditional medicines. More than 3,200 online signatures were put on the internet portal Facebook by late Tuesday, with an additional petition by an Australian animal rights group launched separately, urging the fur company owner in an open letter to stop buying seal pelts from Namibia. In May this year, the European Union banned imports and exports of all seal products in their 27 member states, including transporting these products through the EU to other parts of the world. The sparsely populated southern African country is famous for its wildlife and deserts, especially along its Atlantic quote-unquote skeleton coast. The seals live on a group of islands off the southern coast. And I don't normally do this sort of news, but I saw this and wanted to bring it to everyone's attention. This is a petition that you can go and sign on at the Animal Legal Defense Fund website. That's www.aldf.org for Animal Legal Defense Fund. And the headline that they're using for this press release is "Oppose Puerto Rico's Plan for a Massive Primate Breeding Facility." Join the Animal Legal Defense Fund and an international coalition of attorneys, scientists, and animal advocates in opposing the proposed construction of a massive facility in Puerto Rico for the purpose of breeding primates for use in painful and traumatic laboratory experiments. The proposed facility in Guayama City will, according to plans, breed many thousands of highly intelligent, sensitive macaques for export to research facilities in the United States and around the world, and potentially for on-site and or local experimentation as well. Let Puerto Rican officials know you are part of the international opposition to this cruel plan. Less than 1 year ago, Puerto Rico enacted a landmark animal protection law based in part on a set of model laws drafted by the Animal Legal Defense Fund. The sweeping set of reforms provided in Act 154 placed Puerto Rico among the top tier of U.S. states and jurisdictions with regard to the strength of their laws protecting animals. This new law provides specific guidelines for experimentation on live animals. Specifically, scientific research on animals at universities is allowable only when it meets criteria deeming it, quote-unquote, absolutely essential. Any other experiments are prohibited for educational purposes at the elementary, intermediate, and higher education levels and completely banned in facilities outside of university research labs. The proposed primate breeding facility would violate both the letter and the spirit of Puerto Rico's progressive new law, which strictly limits the use of animals in experimentation. In addition to troubling questions about its legality, such a facility would also place Puerto Rico behind the curve of the current context of scientific debate about laboratory research involving animals. In 2007, the National Academy of Sciences published a report calling on the Environmental Protection Agency to make a fundamental shift in toxicity testing strategies away from testing on mammals and focusing increasingly on new, more accurate, not to mention more ethical in vitro toxicity testing. And that is the news for today. So once again, if you want to check out that petition, I highly recommend you sign it. Stopping a massive primate breeding facility seems like a pretty good idea. So do check out www.aldf.org. That's www.aldf.org for Animal Legal Defense Fund. And the link is pretty obvious on that first page. So once again, you're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ozhovsky, and I am very happy to have Mary Martin today on the program. Mary Martin is a blogger. Her blog can be found at www.animalperson.net. We're going to be talking about the language, economics, and ethics of our relationship with non-human animals. Mary has written extensively on these subjects online and otherwise, and we're going to have a good conversation. Mary, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Great.
And let me just apologize in advance if you hear a noise, because Charles, one of my greyhounds, has decided to take up guard dogging. And when he hears something going on in front of the house, he starts barking like a real dog.
That is...
So it's kind of strange, so I apologize if that occurs, and I will stop it as soon as I can.
Well, not a problem. The show is called Animal Voices,
yeah.
So every...
you might hear some animal voices.
Every once in a while, we do hear some animal voices come through. We've interviewed people in the past who work at shelters, and we've interviewed them at the shelters.
Oh.
And every once in a while, a bark or two peeks through, and that is totally okay. I wanted to start, Mary, by maybe asking you if you could explain the title of your blog. The blog is called Animal Person.
Yeah, I think that could have been a mistake.
Okay.
I grew up calling myself an animal person, or people called me an animal person, and I had no idea that other people were also doing that at the same time, or that there were entire groups, you know, called animal people. And just from a very, very young age, I was very sensitive to the plight of all animals and was one of those kids who enjoyed the company of my cat more than the company of most people. And didn't like the zoo and thought the circus was a horrible thing, and so it really started very young, and people just called me an animal person. So it didn't really come from me. I would have called myself a cat person.
Okay.
If I had a choice, because cats were my thing at the time, but that was what they called me, and so it kind of went with it.
But you're not just a cat person as well. You clearly have a strong affinity for greyhounds as well.
Yeah, and that was a bit of an accident.
Okay.
I moved to Florida about 12 years ago, and I came from New York. And so there I am driving on the interstate, and there's this little green sign with a graphic of a greyhound with a muzzle on, and it says dog track, you know, at, like the exit, you know, dog track this exit. And I thought, that is the strangest thing. I just didn't know that it existed. And then, of course, I discovered that Florida has more greyhound tracks than any other state by far in the country, and kind of took it on because it was it was all around me. And then I started noticing it everywhere, kind of like when you get a new car, all of a sudden you see that car all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Once I started researching greyhound racing, I just couldn't lose them. They were all over. So I decided that would be my next rescue, and I also decided with my husband that we decided to go with a special needs dog, because we figured, you know, if you're going to, you may as well go all the way and go for a dog who nobody else wants.
Right.
And that's how we got Violet. She's diabetic.
Okay. I wanted to ask you maybe if we could rewind a little bit. You mentioned that your concern for animals was something that was present from a really early age. Were there any particular experiences that sort of catalyzed you going vegan or brought you to a more sort of solidified perspective about animal issues?
Yes, I had my little kitty who we got outside of a grocery store. You know, she was in some box when I was 8 years old. And I remember thinking, I wasn't one of those people who read books about animal rights at all.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember thinking, and I asked my mother this, I said, are we going to eat Brady someday? Brady was the name of my cat. And she said, of course we're not going to eat Brady, honey. Some animals are for eating and some are for petting. And I just was having none of that answer. And so I just couldn't do it anymore. And I decided that I wasn't going to eat animals. Of course, my parents are not really excited about this because we all grew up eating animals.
Mm-hmm.
I, at one point, wallpapered my family's kitchen with pictures of veal calves and crates. And I became this vegan without knowing that vegan existed and just trying to piece together eating things when I was 17 years old.
Mm.
And buying just the ugliest shoes in the history of shoes and saying, wait, obviously no wool, no fur. And so I just decided on my own that that's what I was doing. But it was by no means, it didn't stick, for one thing. And it was not any kind of a linear journey. I then, 6 years later, became a vegetarian. I spent an entire year and a half eating filet mignon and salmon 10 years ago. So it wasn't like I'm sticking to this and it's never going to change.
Right.
But something always happened that brought me back. The most recent thing being in 1999 or 2000, when I sliced into a piece of cow flesh, charred, medium rare, and maggots came out of it.
Wow.
And they were just kind of like saying hi. And my soon-to-be husband flipped out. And at that point, I kind of decided, I told him, you know, this isn't who I am. I am not somebody who eats filet mignon and drinks gin martini. I can't do this, and here's why. And I told him exactly how I felt about animals, and that was it. And a couple of years later, he went vegan himself. So although I think that books are powerful, I'm sure that blogs are powerful, posters are powerful, films are powerful, I absolutely believe that you can know things and not do anything about them. And so I would like to believe that most people just simply don't know where their food comes from or how animals are treated or haven't thought about, gee, this is enslavement. But a lot of people have, and they still do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I was someone who was way more sensitive than the average person and knew way more than the average person, and I still did it anyway. So I try to be compassionate about that concept because I was that person for a very long time.
One of the things that you mention on your blog, and maybe you can touch on a little bit about what, because you do write from a particular philosophical perspective, and maybe you can talk about that a little bit. But one of the things that you do mention quite a bit in terms of activism is the idea that vegan education is probably the most important form of activism that can be done. So how would you see that fitting into this idea that, you know, even when people know, they won't necessarily do something?
I think that a multi-pronged strategy, meaning, you know, you can read a book and, you know, God bless you if that does it. But in my experience, the success that I have had converting people from being non-vegans, and I mean, you know, leather-wearing, foie gras-eating people to vegans, takes a decent long time. And is the result of a personal relationship and is the result of constant support and seeing where that person is at and kind of knowing your audience and then tailoring what you're doing to who that audience is and giving them plenty of vegan brownies and vegan cookies
mm-hmm.
and plenty of opportunities to see that there's fantastic fashion that nobody died for. So I think that for me, although I've had pretty decent success with a bunch of people, it by no means was read this pamphlet. You know, it's just
right.
it isn't how it happens. And it's something that you constantly have to nurture. I don't think you give somebody a pamphlet and then you say goodbye to them. And this is, again, my experience. I mean, I created my own pamphlet, and I think it was a complete disaster. I think they need to know tips. They need to have questions answered. They need to know that they need reinforcement that what they're doing is what they really want to be doing. And they need, again, constant recipes and tips for shopping. And it's, you know, little things like that. Oh, it's inconvenient. It really, it's not inconvenient. But let me show you how it's not inconvenient. It's expensive. It's not expensive. But that doesn't help. Let me show you how it's not expensive. You know, let me show you how good it can taste. Role play. You tell me the questions that you're getting from people, or my husband does this all the time. Somebody at work says to me X, you know, what do I say to that? And we'll go through it and formulate something for him to say. But it has to be something that's from him, not something from me. So we have to work on, you know, where does he fit in this conversation? What kinds of things would he say? What's important to him? And then he responds accordingly. So I think that it's a lot more difficult than I thought it was going to be and takes a lot more time.
Maybe on that note, we can take the short break that we need to take for a station ID. And after the break, I'd really like to talk a bit more about the blog, because the sort of conversations that you talk about are always very much happening on that blog. You always leave the questions open and ask people to sort of weigh in for themselves about what they think about the things that you write about, even when they think that by asking the question, you're soliciting a particular opinion.
Right.
So I'd like to come back and talk a bit more about that, and maybe we can get into some stuff about Project Treadstone as well. You are listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Today we're speaking with Mary Martin. Mary Martin is the main writer, actually I think the only writer, at www.animalperson.net. She is an accomplished writer, ghostwriter, editor, and very accomplished blogger. I love the blog. I read it every day, and I am looking forward to talking with her a bit more. So please stay tuned, and we'll be back. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're speaking today with Mary Martin. She is a blogger at www.animalperson.net. And I wanted to ask you, Mary, just to give our listeners maybe a general sense of what they might find coming to animalperson.net, and maybe if you could maybe throw out what you were thinking of blogging about today.
Sure. The tagline, I guess, is Mary Martin, PhD, deconstructs the ethics, language, and economics of our relationship with non-human animals. And it's sort of the literary criticism meets animal rights blog, if you wanted to distill it down. And what I like to do is help people think critically about what they see and what they hear around them with regard to animals, animal rights, and veganism, and to not necessarily trust the mainstream media. I mean, even the New York Times, the Washington Post, advocacy group, PETA, HSUS, you know, just because someone of alleged authority is saying something or saying something a certain way does not make it so. And so what I like to do are these. Here comes Charles, sweetheart, I love you.
Hello, Charles.
Yes, he likes to cry. And so I'd like to deconstruct. I'll take an article or even a statement by an advocacy group and go often sentence by sentence through it and sort of, you know, state, it says this, but what does that mean? It tells you to do this, but what does that mean? It says the words animal rights, but then look in the next sentence what it says about animal rights, and is that what you think animal rights is? It presents a certain picture of animal rights or of vegans. Do you agree with that? This is the point of the article. What do you think about it? And above all, what I don't like doing is saying, this is what you should think about X. And I know I do it sometimes, and I certainly have been given to ranting, I think, like any blogger. But I try my best to just open it up to people, to open up a discussion and have people sort of speak amongst themselves. I used to, at the very beginning, participate a lot in my own comments, and then I realized I was sort of shutting down the discussion because people were looking to me for what's the answer.
Right, because you're the authority on the blog.
Yeah, and so, but who cares about me? You know, I'm really the questioner. I'm not the answerer. You know, and I like to sort of empower people to be the answers of questions and be the questioners of people who are supposed to be the experts. And I don't think that the mainstream American public knows how to do that or is educated about how to do that. And I was lucky enough to get a fantastic liberal arts education and major in British and American literature for my MA, and then applied linguistics, which is basically like literary criticism all over again, for my doctorate. So, you know, that's, I come from doing that as a hobby and for my education, and I have discovered that the average, even the average vegan, the average American animal rights activist doesn't necessarily question enough. And they're just happy, in my experience, I have seen people just happy to find a group of people who they think that they agree with, and then they settle there. And they settle on a team. And, of course, you know, there are teams out there in the community, and I think I've been kicked off of all of them. But but that's sort of, you know, I'm not a team player. There's no I in team. And I've always been a square peg, but I would like more people to leave their teams. And at the very least, more people to question their teams and to stand up to them and to stand up to, you know, their leaders and to say, no, I disagree, or I don't like the way that you're doing this, or I don't like the way you're saying this. And so that's what I'm trying to do on my blog.
Do you think maybe there's a hesitancy to do that in the face of such, you know, for many people in animal rights activist circles, if they're looking at this sort of tremendous amount of horror, and there's sort of maybe a hesitancy to say, well, no, it's okay if I just do my thing individually, or, you know, there's the sort of, like you were mentioning, you know, they're happy to find a group of people who agree and who are willing to do something, and so toes get stepped on, and maybe that's okay in the end, because there's this larger, more important goal that maybe transcends the importance of deconstructing language and making sure that we have a discourse that's clear.
Well, I would give a really kind of wimpy yes and no to that, because I believe that your message is very important. I believe that first, your most important message is your behavior, is your action. And what you say, frankly, is the message that you're trying to tell the world that you believe. And that's a completely different from what you're doing sometimes. And I think that if that's the case, you need to be called out on that. Now, of course, the greatest goal is, you know, the liberation of the animals, the ending of the use of animals, the ending of the suffering of animals. And I don't, if you're going in the divisive direction, I understand that comment, that can be divisive. But I think that there can be dissent and criticism within a movement that isn't necessarily divisive. And I think that in any movement, if there is no dissent, then you're sort of as bad as those who you are fighting, especially when you're talking about freedom. So I like the freedom that I have because I'm not on a team to say what I want to say. I understand that people may not like me as much because of it, but I don't think that I am sacrificing animals in any way for what I am doing, and I would challenge anybody to describe to me how I'm hurting the movement by just deconstructing language. And what I have done, though, I can tell you, is I have altered my strategy. I used to be far snarkier than I am as of late, believe it or not, and I have sort of altered my strategy to being one more who deconstructs what the mainstream is saying than what the movement is saying, because there are people whose sole jobs are that. And that's not me. My fight is not to argue about what PETA is doing and what HSUS is doing. If it happens to be in the news, and if I notice it, maybe, or if it's something that's super egregious, but that's not my battle. My battle is all of you animal rights people, and all of you vegan people, and all of you people who are on the fence and might be coming in this direction, these are the things that you might want to be thinking about while you're formulating what your own belief system is. You know, forget about taking somebody else's. What do you believe, and why do you believe that, and where does that come from? And I think that a belief that comes from inside of you rather than from outside is far more powerful and far less likely to falter. So I just want to help people find out what they believe.
It's an interesting sort of perspective, because I guess in my experience, so many of the sort of internal debates within AR communities are so focused on particular kinds of rhetoric and particular kinds of philosophical positions based in my opinion, largely based on language quibbles. And I'm thinking specifically about things like direct action and violence.
Yeah.
And those things seem to get so bound up in people's identity positions. It's not just about what do you think is the actual correct or right thing. It is so much about how you define yourself. And so it's interesting to hear you say, don't worry about that stuff necessarily. Think about what you actually believe and define yourself that way.
I intentionally stopped, or at least dramatically decreased my usage of the word abolition because of that. And I just found that I was starting more fights than I wanted to deal with that, quite frankly, weren't a good use of my time to moderate. And this is, you know, said with complete love. They're vegans already. I love them. You know, I don't think they're not my target market. You know, if you're already a vegan and you already think that you shouldn't be using animals, and that is the way that you live your life, Mary Martin, does not want to sit at my computer all day, you know, responding to ways that I'm not really an abolitionist. So,
right.
But I will only get that if I use that word.
Right.
So call me whatever you want. But I discovered, in order to lessen my own headaches, that I just had to do things a certain way.
Do you think that moving away a little bit from the sort of internal definitions, do you think that on the outside, animal rights issues, as they get taken up in the media that you so often look at and analyze, are these issues and debates about words, or are they issues of action? I'm thinking specifically about the Proposition 2 stuff that happened in California and all of the sort of back and forth that happened, not just within the movement, but outside of the movement, about whether this was a good thing, a victory, a quote-unquote victory, or not a victory. It strikes me as something very very muddy waters to wade into, at the very least.
It is. I mean, this is a situation where, look at how powerful that language is. You're going to claim victory. First of all, you really have to define that for me. Like, how on earth, in what way is this a victory exactly? But when you claim victory, and I get this in my email box all day long, and I'm sure you do as well, not far after that word is an ask for funds. And if you're not really paying attention to all of these victories, and you're not unpacking what this victory is, and who is it a victory for, and is it enforced, and when is it going to take place, and how is it really that different from what it was before, and what is my goal, and is this going to get to my goal, which, frankly, we don't have the answer to that. We have the answer to that right now, in that none of these things, none of these, quote, victories, have led to us not using an animal. I think we can say that. And that supposedly, you know, if for animal rights, that would be my goal. And I would say, is this leading to, even in the greyhound area, you know, there's legislation that says in a certain state where, you know, they should have to report their injuries more often. What the heck is that? I mean, I look at that and I say, how does that lead to no more greyhound racing? That might lead to more transparency, and then that transparency might lead to the industry doing things differently. So maybe that's like a more like a welfare measure, and maybe the doing of things differently would lead to fewer injuries, but that in no way is going to lead to shutting greyhound tracks down, in my mind, and it hasn't happened yet that way. So I look at the Prop 2 things, and I say, what is my goal? And I don't live in California, so it doesn't matter, but would this proposition further my goal? And if I feel comfortable about that, then I would vote for it. And I did not feel comfortable with any of those things at all. But I was not as enmeshed in the debate because I'm way over here. So I cannot say for sure how it would have come down on it, but it just doesn't seem like that did a heck of a lot. And when you look at in the media, how that was presented as such an overwhelming victory. I think that I can safely say right now that for my goal, that was not a victory. So victory is important because it gets you money. Victory is important because it gets you support. But when you see the word victory, you know, really check out the backstory on that. So that is the case where language is important. When you see an article that says animal rights in one sentence, and then in the next sentence says something like animal welfare, you know, and it's written by a top New York Times columnist, you should say something about that. You should write a letter to them and say, hey, guess what, guys? It's not the same thing. So I think the words are important because we now have a situation where people, the mainstream, is so completely confused. And then even within the movement, there are daily arguments about what things mean. You know, I'd love to say that they're just words, but they are how we make sense of the world. And right now, we are not making sense so well.
I so identified with a post that you made. It was a little while back now, where one of the commenters on one of your posts had asked you to find some good news. And I do the news for this program as well. And so, you know, I'm subscribed to various sort of listservs and that sort of thing that I get, you know, hundreds of stories about cats being skinned alive every week or that sort of thing. And and I so identified with your hunt for good news. And I guess you're sort of maybe touching on that a little bit when you say, you know, take a little peek behind the word victory and see what's actually behind it.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit because on your blog, you at one point experimented with Google Ads. And this was, and I thought it was actually a really interesting moment because not only because of, you know, the fact that the Google Ads that Google was assigning as appropriate to your blog were clearly not appropriate, but because of what your blog is about. So maybe you could tell the listeners a little bit about what happened and why maybe Google Ads is not the best option for an AR blogger.
Yeah, this is what happened. These people at the Animal Rights Zone wrote me and said, we want to, you know, syndicate your blog on our blog, and you have to do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, put our little search thing on your blog. And the woman was very well-versed in, you know, animal person lore. She really knew her stuff about the blog, and because I've been blogging daily for 3 years, and so I didn't really look that much into it, mistake number one. And then daily thereafter, and I really didn't check it. I didn't check it at all. I didn't check to see, you know, what's that page look like that has my stuff on it? And so this wonderful reader who's read for a while from Beijing sent me probably 3 times a week. He would send me a snapshot of the page of my blog with, like, the fur ads on it or, you know, whatever horrifying ads that happened to key in to whatever word that I was using that day. And the point is, it doesn't work. You can't use a system like that. You have to find, if you want to make money, I've never made a penny from my blog. I've never advertised at all on my blog. I don't know a way to do it that wouldn't compromise my beliefs or wouldn't make me beholden to somebody. And it's not like it's not like that's what I do to make money in my life. So I am freed of a lot of the constraints that a lot of bloggers and a lot of writers have in that I'm not hawking something. And then B, I don't have to constantly bring in money from that. So I'm not looking to monetize myself, although people are constantly telling me that I should. If you can think of a way I could do that, I'm happy to hear it. But I don't think that there is a way, given my message and given the number of people who I probably agitate on a daily basis, if they paid attention, I can't imagine who would want to support that because they could be next. And it's not like I'm setting out to bash anybody. I really think that if you want to have a place where you can just tell exactly what you feel, and you can take any example from any place, and you can deconstruct it without any fear of losing ad revenue or whatever, then that is a completely honest place. So I wanted to do this blog in the most honest way possible, and I discovered that the Animal Rights Zone wasn't doing that, and I wrote to them, and I sent them all the snapshots of the Google pages, and I took the stuff off of my site, and I asked to be taken off of theirs. So you know, but it was a weird decision because do you, and I guess this is what most people do, do they want the exposure and do they want the potential money, the potential mm-hmm. dollars that they could get from it, and what are they willing to sacrifice? And to me, it's a no-brainer. I just didn't know it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, for me, it's too much of a sacrifice. It might not be for somebody else.
I want to make sure, we've got about 8 minutes left, and I really want to make sure, speaking of honesty, that we talk about Project Treadstone. Project Treadstone is something that you've clearly been involved with for a while, and it's something that you've written about very frankly and honestly on your blog. So I definitely had trouble finding information on the internet about it outside of the posts that are on your blog. So maybe you could describe to us a bit about what Project Treadstone is, and your involvement with it.
Okay. First, it was this secret project from the Bourne Identity, or the Bourne Ultimatum, one of those shows. And my husband and I, you know, use a lot of code around the house, you know, and we'll just name what we're doing. And so I, of course, had to have a name for this, and we love the idea of Project Treadstone. So I was going to a meeting for a documentary film I was working on, nothing to do with animals, at this building, and there were all of these cats. And it's about 15 miles away from me. And it was at night. And so I almost hit a couple of cats. And I didn't know what was going on with all the cats, but I went back the next day, and of course there were no cats, because they're feral cats. So I went in the building, and I asked around, and I found, of course, a bunch of women who feed the cats. And kind of just did my research around, okay, A, why are you feeding the cats, and how many are there, and do you know that they're just going to keep, have you noticed that they're multiplying, and they're, that's going to keep happening? So what I had to do was educate myself, because there was no, well, there was a group in the area that was doing a trap neuter release, but in South Florida, it was only on the island of Palm Beach, and they sort of don't play well with others. So if the cats weren't on Palm Beach, and they weren't going to help me.
Hmm.
So I had to piece together this, like, ragtag team of people to trap and to, and I at the beginning just picked them all up myself, drove them all to the vet, paid for it, and but it really had to be a case, because there were so many cats, and I'm not somebody, just like I don't give people answers on my blog, I'm not going to like swoop in and take care of somebody's feral cat situation. So I worked with them and I helped them educate themselves, and they bought traps and they made friends with trapper people. And they went to vets, and we researched together, okay, what kinds of things you say to the vet when you're trying to, you know, get them to help you. And we pieced together this project, and, you know, different people driving. At first, again, it was mostly me. And I rehabbed them at, recouped them at my house, and, of course, hit every possible snag you could hit dealing with feral cats. You know, do you test them, do you not? And of course, we went to the first vet we went to, tested them, and someone tested positive. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Does he have symptoms? Do you euthanize him? So we made a policy on the fly, really, for testing or not testing. And I always had all of my Alley Cat Alley's materials with me, and said, Alley Cat Alley does this, and they do this, and this is why. And we managed to work out a system where every Thursday we would trap 2 to 4 cats, and they would come to my house, and then, of course, you know, if they were pregnant, oh, that situation, you know, you don't hit it, you don't realize what's going to happen until all of a sudden the vet says she was pregnant with 6 babies and they were almost full term, and you realize, oh my gosh, they just died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did that happen? How exactly did that happen? And how do you feel about that? And so it took a couple of months to get it down to a science, but the site now, I don't think, has any feral cats left. So, but the next step, because they live in and around an abandoned building, is going to be finding a place to relocate all of them, and then trapping them all and moving them there, and then getting funding to take care of them for the rest of their lives.
So this project is still ongoing?
Yep. It just doesn't stop. And there's an a lot of abandoned construction sites in downtown West Palm, and so people also noticed, and there's also a lot of foreclosures in the area, that there were cats. So they would drop off their house cat when they left their home, because their home was foreclosed on. So all of a sudden you'd see during the day these kind of well-fetished looking clueless cats who were never there before. And so then we had the situation where we could adopt some of these cats because they were somebody's cat before. They weren't just feral. So it's issue upon issue, from, you know, how young can you get them and socialize them, to who the heck is going to do that, to do you microchip them? What happens when one gets hit by a car, and who takes care of that? And so I found that I was quite impressed, because the last time there was an issue where actually a cat got hit by a car, they called me not to say, oh my gosh, what to do, help me, which is what the first, you know, couple dozen phone calls were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like I knew, but I'm very resourceful, so I can figure something out. But now the phone call is, oh, this is what happened, and this is how we dealt with it. So they don't need me anymore.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about, in the beginning, if you saw any sort of, because we've been talking about language and rhetoric, this is obviously a very real-life thing that you're doing. This is a course of action that you took, and I'm wondering how, even in your interactions with the vets or with the original people who had been feeding the cats, what kind of idiosyncrasies of language or rhetoric that you noticed in the beginning?
Well, people, first, they don't, and this isn't really so much an idiosyncrasy as a point of education, they don't understand what a feral cat is. And they don't understand that, you know, that they're not going to take this cat home someday, you know, because there were a couple of gorgeous Siamese-ish looking. Of course, nobody wants the black cats. And so they were attached to the attractiveness of the cat and the idea of cuddling with the cat, and not attached at all to the needs of the cat or what the cat actually is, which is a wild cat that at no point are you taking home and cuddling with. And so it was this kind of re-educating of the people, and they're the people who've been around the cats for 5 years, mind you. But re-educating them about what the cats are and how you can best meet their needs. And so the original discussions were about needs, and what the people didn't realize was that they had their own needs, and they were trying to sort of fill the needs they had for the cats rather than saying, what are the cats' needs and how can we fill those needs? So it was this really kind of nuanced conversation at the beginning, where there was a lot of listening, and the listening was around, where are these people coming from, and why are they so upset about the cats? What is it that they're upset about, and what need is it that they think that they're going to fill? And then let's kind of work with that and move to the reality of the situation, which is that you need to be in a position to fill them, and if your needs don't get filled, that's got to be okay. You have to release, it's like this ego release, you know, you have to release what you've got around the animal and just say, I'm going to be here to do whatever I can do for that animal. And then, of course, there were the people who thought, if you feed them, they're going to multiply, true, and so you need to kill them. And again, a matter of education, you know, you take them out, you kill them, you know, you've got to get every last one of them. There, it is going to create a vacuum. You are going to get more cats, not to mention that's not humane. So I think around every single aspect of a feral cat's life, they were pretty much going with what they had been taught their whole life. Just like if you ask them what they ate, they had been going with what they were taught their entire life. And one night my husband had to go and pick up the cats, and he made some, like, vegan joke, and he said nobody laughed. And I said, honey, they're not vegans. And this was his first experience with, how can you care so much? He's so cute, he's so naive. How can you care so much about just this one thing, about these feral cats, and really care and be willing to give to them and give money to them and give time to them and energy to them, and then go home and eat a chicken? And so what I tried to do, and this is the same thing that I try to do with the greyhounds. The greyhounds are the greatest sneaky activism opportunities, because when you have a greyhound next to you, it's the opportunity to talk about a lot of things, and the same thing with the feral cat. And I take those opportunities to bring the discussion around to food, around to why we're using the animals, around to entertainment. And I don't know how much success I have had, because I don't know what these people are doing now in their lives, but what I do know is that they're thinking in a different way. And my goal is always to leave a conversation not with somebody having completely, you know, shifted their lives, because I'm not that narcissistic, but with somebody saying, you know, maybe I should do that differently. Maybe I should look into that. Maybe I should think about that differently. Maybe I shouldn't use that word. I know somebody keeps saying, like, I'm sweating like a pig, stuffed, something about a pig. And, you know, even getting people to question their idiomatic usages. So that's my goal. My goal as an animal person, as an activist, you know, inside my house and outside of my house, is get people thinking and then getting people to change their behavior according to that thinking.
Mary, we are out of time. We're actually a little bit over time. Thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Not a problem.
And thank you for reading.
No problem. And I will continue to read. And if I see little bits, maybe with your permission, I can share some of your thoughts on the air from time to time.
I'd be on.
Great. Thank you so much for being on the program. And if you are blogging today, I will check it out.
Thank you very much. You have a great day.
You too. Bye. You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We are way over time, but coming up next is Dos Mundos with Sergio, and it's going to be a great show. I am sure of it. Stay tuned.